For the week of January 10th, 2010, this is Showbiz Sandbox, Episode 37, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in Los Angeles, I'm Karen Woodward.
And in New York, I'm Michael Giltz.
Oh, this time you're in New York. Okay, well, you know, beats a Dairy Queen and beats a Cranky Cafe.
I just give you lots of beats to play with, you know, lots of different, I'm like an actor.
Well, we should probably jump right into it today because we have a ton of news to talk about, everything from some American Idol news and some primetime NBC news, and I wonder if anybody has guessed what that's going to be about. And we'll talk about CES, and we'll talk about some Netflix news. Yeah, some Netflix news. They cut a deal with Warner Brothers, and Will Richman from Video News will be here to tell us what that's all about. But first, you know, last week, Michael, you mentioned that if Avatar did well this weekend, all bets were off. Well, did it do well?
Absolutely, it did. It was another huge weekend at the box office. It made $48 million. It only dropped 30%. It is now finally, for all the money it's made, it just passed Transformers: Revenge of the Fallen as the number one movie released in 2009. Thank God, because I'd rather see Avatar 10 times than Transformers. It's the number two top grossing movie worldwide of all time. It still has like four or five movies ahead of it to try and catch up to Titanic in the U.S., which made $600 million in the U.S. and $1.2 billion worldwide. But putting it all aside, it made a huge amount of money. It's showing legs. It's 4 weeks. It's the second highest grossing movie of all time. How long it'll keep going for, nobody knows, but it certainly didn't drop this week. And it's at $1.3 billion, and it's got its eye poised on Titanic. So it needs another $500 million to become the top grossing film of all time. Oof. And I added to the take this week because I went to see it again.
How many times have you seen it now?
Oh, just two. Two is plenty. But I have to say the 3D looked better this time when I didn't have to concentrate on the story. The number two movie of the week was Sherlock Holmes, also a big hit. It made $16 million. Alvin the Chipmunks made $16 million. Both those movies are barreling towards $200 million. Both definitely big success stories. Daybreakers was number four. I made $15 million. It's an Ethan Hawke film about a world in which vampires are in control, but they're running out of blood. And it's a decent opening for a B movie that sat on the shelf for 2 years. Number five was It's Complicated, the Meryl Streep film, which grossed another $11 million. It's at $76 million, still looking to trudge towards $100 million. Leap Year opened pretty weakly. That's the Amy Adams film, the romantic comedy, that made $9 million. And The Blind Side and Up in the Air made another $7 million. Michael Cera had perhaps his first lead role in a lot of ways. He was in Youth in Revolt, which made a pretty good $7 million for a small film. And at number 10 was The Princess and the Frog, which made $4.7 million, is just trying to leap its way to $100 million. It's at $92 million total. And in limited release is The Young Victoria, which I finally saw and quite enjoyed. It was a really good movie. I'm surprised it didn't get more attention come the end of the year. But Avatar's huge. Daybreakers had an okay opening. I saw that as well. And Young Victoria was my favorite movie in limited release. What movies did you guys see?
I saw Leap Year.
Oh, how was it?
It's bad. It's bad,
it got really
but
bad reviews.
It picks up in the second half of the movie, which is sort of unusual for movies. And there were a couple of scenes in the end which had most of the women in my theater sobbing.
Oh, really?
So, you know, it's a bad movie, but if you like romantic comedies, there will be scenes in this that will grab you.
So I have
but
to see
Amy
it.
Adams could have done better.
Yeah. You know, I hated the trailer so much because it showed literally the entire film up to the finale where, you know, the two men are facing. I mean, I'm not giving anything away.
Oh,
it's
but that's
trailer.
Not the finale.
Well, it felt like the finale. I'm glad, but it still was a bad trailer. It showed us 80% of the movie then, perhaps.
Well, I was walking past a movie theater this week. I know it's hard for me to do that, but I happened to be walking past one and I saw the poster for Leap Year. And it turns out Deborah Kaplan and Harry Elfont, two NYU alumni I went to school with, they wrote the movie.
Well, God bless them. Too bad it didn't get better reviews, but they got a film made, and hopefully it'll make enough money that they'll be able to make some more.
Well, they've had several films made, yeah.
Oh, well, well.
Deborah Kaplan is actually married to Brecken Meyer.
Oh, that's why I know her name. Yeah.
Yes.
They were doing something for Paramount. Did they write How to Lose a Guy in 10 Days?
They wrote and directed Can't Hardly Wait and Josie and the Pussycats, and they wrote The Flintstones Viva Rock Vegas and Surviving Christmas.
She wrote and directed Can't Hardly Wait, and Fooled Around with the Star, I guess, assuming she met him on the set of that film, Breckenmeyer.
No comment. I wasn't there.
Good for her. I would have done the same thing. Well, it was a good week at the box office. Avatar is really massively successful.
What's really amazing about it is that last weekend was a holiday weekend. So Friday, people had time to go see the movie all day since it was New Year's Day, and it still only dropped 29%.
Yeah. I did appreciate it more technically this time. I think I was in a better seat. My 3D worked better, and I wasn't having to pay attention to the story. So I was really just looking at the effects and the background and all the detail. And I still think the movie is designed poorly. I think that the planet looks ridiculous. You know, everywhere they walk, it lights up and it's all purple and pink. But the 3D effect, I did enjoy more seeing on this second time. I have no desire to see it a third time and no desire to watch it on DVD at home in 3D. No way. It's 2 hours and 40 minutes. But it was interesting.
Well, I should probably get around to seeing it for a first time, right?
Yeah, you can't watch it at home. You got to see it in the theater. You got to just grit your teeth and get it over with.
Okay.
Something else you can't watch at home, at least not after February 12th, will be Jay Leno in prime time. On Thursday, the internet it kind of lit up with news that NBC would be reversing its controversial decision to air the Jay Leno show in prime time 5 nights a week. And then numerous stories surfaced, quoting, of course, unnamed sources inside NBC, that reported the network was thinking of reducing the Jay Leno show to half an hour, moving it to 11:35 p.m., after the late local news, and then pushing the Tonight Show with Conan O'Brien to a half hour.
Right, and it's all official now. Jay Leno is out. They're kicking him out of prime time. They don't know what they're going to do in late night. They don't have a deal set with anyone. They don't know if Conan's going to walk and go to Fox or ABC. They don't know if Jay Leno's going to walk. They don't know if Jay Leno will take back, if he'll be happy with half an hour at 11:30, whether Conan would accept being pushed back half an hour. It's a big mess.
But the bigger news, of course, almost kind of showing up this news, which only happened yesterday on Sunday. On Monday morning, it turns out Simon Cowell, who is one of the judges and creators of American Idol, may be leaving.
Is leaving, absolutely leaving. He's leaving and he's going to launch his UK show, The X Factor. It's going to be on Fox. It's going to air in the fall and it starts in 2011. So he'll do this season through, you know, May of 2010. And then in the fall, about a year and a half later, he will launch his own show, The X Factor, which is very similar to American Idol. But Fox has also said they plan on keeping Idol on the air for years to come. They always wanted American Idol to air twice a year. And Simon Cowell fought them tooth and nail about that because he thought it was a bad idea. But in a way, they're finally getting their wish because American Idol will continue to air in the spring. Who knows who the judges will be? And Simon Cowell will be on in the fall with his own version called The X Factor. Do you think this is exciting, Karen, or is it a bad news for American Idol, or does it matter? Will it be over?
Well, I think that American Idol had reached its peak anyway. I think that with Adam Lambert, it was kind of a last gasp of excitement, and people were all saying, oh, you know, American Idol is back. But I don't think so. I think it's kind of on its way down anyway. And Simon Cowell is clearly a really smart businessman in terms of plugging in and out of the zeitgeist. I think this is a bad thing for American Idol and a really good thing for X Factor, especially if he brings Paula.
Yeah, he said they asked him about the rumors that he would bring Paula onto the show, and he said, I miss and I adore Paula. So read into that what you will. He didn't say he was doing it or had reached out to her, but it would be a smart thing to do when launching X Factor. I'm sure he'll do it. It's too obvious a thing not to do. And maybe one reason he left was he thought they were dumb about that. But obviously Sperling doesn't care at all. But I think this is the number one show in the country. It may be down to 26 million viewers, but that's a lot more than any other show on any other network. So American Idol is not by any stretch, you know, dead. But wow, two of them on, you know, winter and fall, that could become overkill. I don't know what I'll definitely watch the X Factor, but will I be interested in watching Idol in the spring? I'd rather have one big show rather than have two shows cannibalize each other. If I was Fox, I would have said goodbye American Idol and let's do X Factor, because Simon Cowell's the star of that show.
Well, and he'll also be the producer as well as a judge. So for him, it could be a monetary windfall if the show is successful.
Well, yeah, I mean, he makes $30, $40, $50 million a year off American Idol and all and that's just in the U.S. alone. It doesn't count overseas and the X Factor in the U.K. I mean, he makes tons of money and he could have probably announced his own deal. And I believe he has a producing title on American Idol as well. I'd be shocked if he doesn't.
He does not.
Yeah, no, he'll be in even more control, of course, on the X Factor.
He does not. He is an employee of American Idol.
I'm not sure that's right. I think we're going to need to check that.
According to the LA Times.
Really?
Yes.
Doing a talent show twice in 1 year didn't work for So You Think You Can Dance. I don't think it's going to work for American Idol.
Well, something else that didn't work was NBC's move of Jay Leno to prime time. Yesterday, during the Television Critics Association press tour, Jeff Gaspin, who is the NBC Universal TV chairman, addressed reporters. He said, while performing at acceptable levels for the network, it did not meet our affiliate needs. We realized we had to make a change. He went on to say, my goal is to keep Jay, Conan, and Jimmy as part of the late night lineup. And that's really part of the problem, is that they're trying to keep all three and there's just no way to do it.
What about poor Carson Daly?
Well, Carson Daly, I mean, he is just kind of like off. I mean, I can't imagine that they're going to keep him on. If this plan to move the Jay Leno show to 11:35 and to move...
Well, if Conan doesn't want to move, they're going to have to give him $40 to $50 million. And then he goes to Fox and his show starts at 11. So I don't know what they'll do. They may be desperate enough just to cut Conan loose. He may not want to move to midnight. But I think everybody's losers here. You've got NBC's a loser because they tried something and it didn't work. And they've got everybody unhappy, all their big stars. And they make a lot of money off late night. Jay Leno's unhappy because he failed in primetime. Conan's unhappy because he's getting his ass kicked by Letterman. And now they wanted to move back to midnight. It's humiliating. So there's just no good solution to any of this.
Well, wait a second. In Conan's defense, Conan the Barbarian.
Conan the late night host.
In Conan's defense, though, he had a week lead-in with the Leno show having already dropped the viewership.
Absolutely.
So he did not have the same, 10, 15 million viewers of an ER going into the late local news.
They're going to the local news, you mean, yeah.
Yeah, so to his defense,
he had a weaker lead in, but tough. there's no question that he had a weaker lead in, but there's no question that he hasn't looked good. Getting built by 2 million viewers is a big difference. Viewing habits are hard to change, and everybody looks bad out of this, except Letterman and Craig Ferguson, who's the best guy in late night.
Oh, he is hilarious.
He's great.
Yeah,
right after
Jimmy Fallon is awful.
Ugh, I can't believe he's still on the air.
I would do a better job than Jimmy Fallon.
Gaspin said what's important to Jay is telling jokes at 11:30, and what's important to Conan beyond that was having the franchise of The Tonight Show. I couldn't satisfy either with everything they wanted, which is why I came up with this compromise. That's what Gaspin said.
Right, but neither of them seems to be happy about it yet. Conan certainly hasn't.
The compromise being the 10 o'clock show for Leno, or the compromise being the potential of him being on at 11:30?
Yeah, that compromise. The deal he suggested, which neither of them has jumped at and said okay with, I don't think that's going to satisfy anyone. But of course, I was wrong when I thought they wouldn't try and push Leno back into 11:30. So what do I know? But it's ugly. I think Conan fits better with Fox. You have Fox and then local
I
news
do,
at 10.
A little younger.
And Conan was on at 11. I think that makes sense. So I think NBC should be, scared a little bit.
Well, Mark Berman, who has been on this show previously, and he's with Media Week's Programming Insider, he said he's never seen anything this bad network-wise in his experience. He says that both Leno and O'Brien are now wounded and that it would be a bad idea to take a failed show, which is, in this case, the Jay Leno show, cut it in half, and then schedule it for later at 11:35. Berman feels it would be messing with the Tonight Show formula, which has worked for decades at that time slot. His suggestion is to move Leno back to 11:35 p.m. in The Tonight Show, keep Jimmy Fallon at 12:35 p.m. with The Late Show, and just kind of let Conan move somewhere else, possibly Fox. Is that something you guys agree with?
No matter what is decided, no one's going to be happy. So at this point, NBC's got to do what's best for NBC, and that's probably it.
Yeah, I think it makes a lot more sense than doing this half-hour thing, trying to keep everybody, making everybody miserable is what that would do. Jay doesn't has half an hour of a show. Conan's pushed back to midnight. Jimmy Fallon's on at 1. They'd all be unhappy. So I think Mark Berman's right that you just pay Conan $45 million and go and hope that Jay is not so wounded at 11:30 and that Letterman doesn't have so much momentum that he's able to regroup. Of course, they have nothing to air in 10 p.m. I mean, they don't have enough shows in the hopper. They're going to show Dateline and reality stuff. So they're
not prepared for this at all.
Well, they have six pilots that they just greenlight from the likes of David E. Kelley, Jerry Bruckheimer, House creator David Shore, and Without a Trace creator Hank Steinberg.
So can't they do anything new and right and fresh? It seems to me like this is just another screw up.
Well, it is a screw up.
Bruckheimer, yeah, okay, he makes hit shows. But I mean, a David E. Kelly Law Show? Oh my God, Z. Oh, I can't. I'm not going to watch that show.
David E. Kelly did not do Lost.
JJ. No, Law. Another Law,
law show.
Oh, okay.
It's a big, big mess. I don't think it's the stupidest thing they ever did. They kept Jay away from Fox and ABC. It was a valiant try. Networks have stripped shows practically in prime time. They had Dateline on four nights a week. 2020 was on three or four nights a week. Back in the 60s, Peyton Place, the primetime soap, was on five nights a week. So I think Leno was perfectly reasonable thing to do, but they should have had more drama pilots in the hopper and waiting. They shouldn't have cut loose Southland, for example, and they should have been prepared for it not to work, and they weren't.
Yeah, well, especially since Southland is produced by John Wells, who is the head of the Writers Guild. And they're actually going to have some trouble with creatives. Kurt Suter, who is the, or maybe it's Kurt Sutter, who writes a blog called Sutter Inc. He is the producer and writer of The Shield and Sons of Anarchy. His blog is well worth reading. He wrote that watching Jay Leno, quote, was like watching a fat man run the marathon. You can cheer for him, pray for a miracle, but ultimately you know he'll end up in a puddle of his own puke at the 2 mile marker. And I'll tell you, that was the mild stuff from his blog.
Well, he's nothing but an enemy of, you know, a five night a week strip talent, a talk show. So it's no surprise that he'd feel like that, because that took away five slots of work for them.
Now, who gets the lion's share of the blame for this? Is this something that we can blame on Ben Silverman, or can we blame this on Jeff Zucker? Whose fault is this?
The LA Times had a story this week or weekend about that very question, asking whether this is something that is going to stick to Jeff Zucker. And they pointed out that he is a guy that comes from a news background. He's a tactician. He likes the short-term fix. He doesn't really think strategically. So he made this decision and thought, great, perfect. I keep Leno. I keep Conan. I put somebody else in the late show. And everybody's happy. And we don't have to compete in that time slot with one of our former employees, i.e. hosts, such as Jay Leno. And everybody was happy. But what he didn't foresee was that the drop-off of that 10 to 11 o'clock hour for the local network affiliates would be so huge that they would revolt. And that's exactly what wound up happening. And they were going to go public with it. And at a time when NBC Universal is being pursued for a sale to Comcast, that's not something you need.
Yeah. How could they not have anticipated that with the affiliates?
Well, they, you know, he was drawing 5 to 6 million viewers in late night, and they were hoping he'd increase his audience because he was on earlier. They thought, well, maybe he'll get 8 and 10.
They've gone on record as saying, even at the time, that they didn't expect him to raise his numbers.
Well, that was what they were guaranteeing, but they had to have hoped that that he would do better. They certainly didn't expect him to do, you know, almost worse than he did in late night.
But they should have been prepared. They should have said, what if he only gets the same numbers he's getting in late night? What, did somebody say, ah, nah? Just trust me.
We weren't a part of the behind-the-doors conversations that took place there, but it seems like they didn't really think this all the way through to the very last affiliate who was going to jump ship and preempt Jay Leno to the 11:30 hour.
Well, we know they didn't think it through because they don't have any dramas waiting in the wings.
Yeah, good point.
We know they didn't think it through because NBC is at the bottom of the heap.
Well, and I guess they now they're going to lose money on airing the Winter Olympics for the first time. They've never lost money on this before.
I don't know why they're planning to lose money in the Olympics. I don't understand.
Get that either. I thought they made lots of money advertising, right?
Well, yeah, but they say because of the economic slowdown and the recession that their sales just weren't as brisk, weren't as good, and that they are up to the levels that they had in Torino and Salt Lake City, the last two Winter Olympics from 4 and 8 years ago, but that is not good enough for this year, and they will actually lose money this time for the first time ever.
Well, I'm going to be watching the Olympics. I'm so addicted to them. Michael, you must be too, right?
I do, but I'm much more of a Summer Olympics guy. But I certainly watch the
Winter Olympics girl.
Well,
no, I know. I watch the ice skating. I'm all down. I'm down with the ice skating.
I'm down with the ice skating. I'm down with Apollo Ono, Bodie Miller.
and curling. Let's not forget curling.
And curling. Let's not forget curling.
Well, maybe you can watch the Winter Olympics on one of those new OLED or 3D television sets that premiered at CES this past week.
Or maybe you'll be watching it in 3D.
Maybe. Maybe we should get David Kolker from the Los Angeles Times on the line to tell us more about it.
That's a good segue.
Yeah. Well, thank you. Each January, more than 100,000 people gather in Las Vegas for the Consumer Electronics Show, or CES, the world's largest consumer technology trade show. Most of the gadgets, computers, video cameras, and home theater equipment that look so shiny in Best Buy catalogs later throughout the year debut at this show, which features over 2,700 exhibitors, including some of the world's largest equipment manufacturers. Think Sony, Hewlett-Packard, Canon, and this year, even Apple showed up. Joining us to discuss this year's CES, which just wrapped up over the weekend, is David Kolker, a business reporter covering technology for the Los Angeles Times. David just returned from CES, where he covered the latest development in 3D and web-enabled TVs. His reports from CES can be found on the Los Angeles Times tech blog, www.latimes.com/technology. We'll place a link to it in the show notes. You can also follow David on Twitter. The username to look up is David Kolker, all one word. David, thank you for joining us.
Oh, you bet. Glad to.
Now, it seemed like the big news out of this year's CES, at least for those of us that weren't there, who are reading about it through your blog and others, was 3D television.
Oh, it was all 3D all the time. I mean, I was just surprised they weren't implanting glasses on us. I mean, it was just everybody was, even products that had nothing to do with 3D would just say, you know, it was just on everyone's mind, which is astonishing because the 3D they're talking about, the new 3D TVs they're talking about, it, there's not one of them for sale yet. None of them really come up for sale until March, April, the spring, sometime in there. And yet they were being pushed like crazy. The television companies, the major manufacturers, that's just about all they wanted to talk about.
Well, and Sony and Panasonic announced some 3D initiatives. A new television network featuring 24/7 three-dimensional content will be launched in 2011 by Sony, the Discovery Channel, and IMAX. And this network will be available in the U.S. before expanding internationally. But at the same time, ESPN announced plans for a 3D network that will show about 85 live sporting events in 3D. And then when it's not showing live sporting events, it'll just be dark.
And don't forget DirecTV. Before any of that happens, DirecTV says they're going to have out, concurrent with Panasonic getting their sets out sometime in the spring or, you know, early summer, something like that, that they're going to have for their subscribers, for their DirecTV HDTV subscribers, will be able to get three all 3D channels. So they'll be, you know, that was one of the big questions with 3D TV. I mean, sure, maybe people were, going to be presented with this opportunity to buy a new TV, but would there be anything for it? And at least as soon as this spring, if you're a DirecTV subscriber, you'll have stuff directly coming down from the satellite. And also, just before CES in December, they announced the new Blu-ray standard. Not only do they want you to buy a new TV, they want you to buy a new Blu-ray machine. These new Blu-ray machines, according with this standard, will be able to show Blu-ray movies, Blu-ray movie discs in 3D that are issued out in that new format.
Okay, I just have one word as a question. Why?
Oh, why? Well, I'll tell you from their point of view, there's nothing. This is not a new product. This is a new product category, and there's nothing more the consumer electronic world likes than a new category that people can glom onto. I mean, your television set works. It's working just fine in the living room, but they're saying, nope, you got to dump that thing or put it in the kids' room or put it in the basement or whatever, because now you got to buy a new set just so you can also get the 3D. Now, whether this works or not, I'm old enough I can remember quadraphonic sound. Oh, you got to get rid of that stereo because now you're going to have quadraphonic sound. That never really took off. And surround sound for even in home theaters with the speakers in the back and everything else, that was never such a huge hit. They're hoping that this time it catches on. I can't ever remember such a huge push of a product on just about universally among the major manufacturers without there even being one available yet. They're all hoping this is a new category. People are just going to love it. They're going to want to sit there in the living room and watch content in 3D.
But David, I just bought my plasma screen TV. It cost me about $1,200, $1,400 and a Blu-ray player and
speakers. Oh, you poor baby. You didn't get the 3D.
Yeah. I feel like this is a product looking for an audience. I feel like they're desperate to have some new toy that they can foist on us and that there isn't the demand for it. To me, it doesn't make sense. I mean, like if you have people coming over to watch a football game, how many pairs of glasses do you have on hand? Do you have 4, 6, 8? You know, at $50 a pop, that's really starting to add up.
One for each. And what people weren't talking about there were prices. And in fact, another important thing they weren't talking about, except in very general terms, was bundling. Do the glasses come with the TV? How many glasses come with the TV? And if you got to buy them all a cart because you got friends coming over to watch a special, you know, live event at the All-Star game or the Olympics or the, as you said, the football game or whatever, you know, the Academy Awards, whatever they end up showing in 3D, that you got to have glasses for everybody. And how much is this going to cost? There are two different kinds of glasses. They're probably going to have very different prices. excuse me, sorry. I brought back a cold from CES. One thing of being pressed in with 100,000 people for several days.
Is it a 3D cold?
Yes, my cold's in 3D. You could really tell if you had the glasses. So indeed, you know, they are searching for an audience here. They're hoping the thing that really they're encouraged about is that several films shown in 3D have been very big hits in 3D, even though you generally pay a few bucks more when you go to the movie theater to see Avatar in 3D or Up, the Pixar Disney film in 3D and so forth. And they're thinking, you know, people are really ready for this. They're really ready to watch sporting events. I think actually that's kind of their best bet, is that people will kind of want to watch live sports events. But, you know, it's a very different experience. When you're in a theater, you're in an isolated space, all your attention is on the screen. You're not talking to your neighbor, hopefully. You're not texting, hopefully. Or, you know, when you're watching in your living room with friends or even by yourself, it's a very different experience. You're answering the phone. You're getting up to make a sandwich. You're going to the restroom. You're talking to whoever's in the living room with you. If you have kids, you know, you're dealing with the kids. And by the way, how thrilled are they going to be if they're small to keep the glasses on? So there's a lot of unanswered questions. Who knows? People might take to this like crazy and even feel that even in this economy that they're willing to spend the money for yet another television. And as I said, we don't know how much those televisions are going to cost. Analysts say generally that if they cost more than 10% of current TVs, and current TVs are, you know, the prices are way, way down, that could mean trouble for 3D, that they may not be able to really sell to the public if it's much more of a bump up than that. But we'll see.
Well, now you talk about some unanswered questions, and some of those unanswered questions regard the standards surrounding 3D televisions. You mentioned that there were two sets of glasses. One is passive, one is active. So the active ones are shutter glasses. And these standards have not yet been solidified. How much will these standards affect the rollout and adoption of consumer 3D technology, or will it not be an issue at all?
Well, the big bump they had to get over was getting Blu-ray standard set, so that Blu-ray disc all, and we all remember the nightmare that when Blu-ray came out, there was also HD DVD, and they were battling it out, and different studios were aligned with each, and people were buying each, and one wouldn't play the other, and that was a nightmare. And finally, Blu-ray won, and HD DVD essentially went away. This time, they got the standard set before the machines came out, at least in regard to Blu-ray. They got that, as I said, the standard was set in December before any machines were made. And now, everybody knows, all the manufacturers know, that they're going to make them in this format. And the studios know, when whoever's shooting this stuff is going to make it so it, you know, so it can, the disc can be made that it plays this particular format. The whole question about the glasses, it's not a huge one, because whatever your set comes with, or whatever your set is made with, whether you have to buy the glasses separately or it comes with them, is going to be what you'll use on your particular TV. You may not be able to take your glasses. The one question that does come up, of course, as you pointed out on formats on the glasses, is if you have the active shutter glasses, you're not going to be able to take them to your neighbor's house if your neighbor has a television that uses polarized glasses. The difference between those two is that polarized glasses is what you're using now if you go to the theater to watch Avatar or Up or one of those films. Generally, you're going to be wearing a set of polarized glasses. They're kind of gray tint a little bit. You can see them. They're not like anything like in the very, very, very old days of 3D when they were first fooling around with it. They were making those two tint glasses. A lot of the TVs that are going to come out are going to use those polarized glasses. There is that other technology that you mentioned, the active, the shutter glasses, and they actually work differently. They actually flutter open alternatively, left and right eye, so fast that you can't see that fluttering motion. And I've had them on. You really can't see it. They're battery operated. You can't hear it. It's like you're just looking out through a set of glasses, but they are fluttering, you know, they're alternating your view left and right at an incredibly fast rate. And the televisions those goes with, Panasonic said they're going to be using the shutter glasses. Also, I believe Sony said they're going to. They're going to be controlled by a system in the television, which is essentially activating those glasses and making them go, you know, that rapid kind of pace. So, you know, the question of standards is not too much. I guess if you had one polarized set in the house, another set of active, I mean, that could be a little confusing and everything. But generally, whatever set you have is the type of glasses that you're going to use. Now, the active shutter glasses are most likely going to be more expensive.
Yeah, they're about $60 a pair.
Yeah, it varies. I've heard 50 and I've heard 100. You know, again, no one's really saying how much those are, and no one's saying really how much bundling there's going to be. I imagine there's going to have to be some bundling, at least in the higher price sets, you know, for people to be attracted to them.
Now, what about these networks that Sperling just brought up that are only going to be featuring 3D content? Is that strictly for sports, or?
You know, the DirecTV folks talked about theirs, and they say it's going to be a mixture of things. They said it's definitely going to be sports. One of the things they were talking about was they have a deal to do the Major League Baseball All-Star Game this summer. It's going to be shot in 3D. And by the way, of course, if you shoot something in 3D, you got to have the 3D cameras at the event. So this is not just something you can – well, there's a whole thing we'll talk about in a second, which is 2D, transferred to 3D. That's a whole different thing. But normally, for really true, good quality 3D, you're going to have a whole set of cameras that just shoot 3D there.
Just tell me what you think about 3D TV. I'm convinced that they're just dying for a new product, and they're just all hoping we'll do it. But most people I know just invested in a giant TV, and when you tell them, oh, you have to spend an extra $300, $400 on glasses, and, you know, a 3D movie once every month or so is one thing, but people watch 30, 40 hours of TV a week, and they're not going to want to sit there with glasses on them. And it seems a wildly expensive proposition for something you would use only once in a great while. I think they're just way not even ahead of the game. I just don't see it happening.
I think you could be very possibly right, but I always bet on the wrong thing. That's why I'm a journalist and not an investment banker. They may make this so alluring to folks, and folks are staying home more. They're not going out more for expensive vacations and expensive nights in the town and so forth. They may figure, you know, we want this. And I'll tell you, another thing that encouraged the industry is that there were terrific sales last year in LED backlit televisions. This is this new flavor of LCD. It uses LED lights instead of the old-fashioned fluorescent lights. It can be made really thin and really sexy. They're really thin, and people loved that, and they went out and bought them. They went out and bought them, even though in many cases they were twice as much money as regular LCD. So the industry is looking at that and saying, hey, you know, people are willing to spend for a little bit, you know, a little bit glitzier screen. Why not 3D? Why not give them a whole new experience with 3D? You know, I find it hard to imagine that they're going to meet their expectations on this. But, you know, they sure did it on that one technology. And that may have even been more expensive of a bump up, at least last year, than 3D.
Was there anything at this year's CES that really caught your eye? Any technology or any gadget that really stood out?
Well, I'll tell you, I'm a TV guy, so I cover TVs, and so I was mainly looking at that. And I'll tell you, of all the 3D flavors, Toshiba — sounds horribly effete to say that, but Toshiba, I've been talking to them enough that I use the Japanese pronunciation, or probably I mangled the Japanese pronunciation. But anyway, Toshiba came out with the Cell TV. This was a really good surprise. No one was really expecting this that I know of. The Cell chip is an extremely, extremely fast processor. It's used now in Sony's PS3 game console. Very, very fast. But they say it's so powerful that it has a processor that can be used to make even 2D programming appear to have depth, appear to have some 3D, look to it with glasses, with the same old glasses problem. But also, they say that content you get from the internet, and more stuff is coming over this internet connectivity, you know, that right now it's a walled garden. Right now, most of the services that they're coming over in the internet are — they pick and choose. They make deals. They make deals with Netflix or Blockbuster or Yahoo for their widgets, so-called widgets, which give you some news, some, you know, sports scores and so forth, that they say they can get that in much higher quality. And with more things being delivered over the internet, including movies, They say they can just give you much, much better picture with this faster processor. This thing could be really, really interesting. Now, they didn't really much show it at the show. They were showing it just briefly at the press conference. They say it's coming in the future, but they say it's not too far off. And the main thing is they wouldn't talk about the price. Scott Ramirez is the vice president of marketing. When he was talking about it, he said, quote, "We don't have to rush to the bottom." They figure the experience with LED backlit TV shows that people will shell out bucks when it comes to their favorite, you know, consumer electronics device in the house, the television.
Well, thank you very much, David. Of course, everybody can read your posts and your writing on the LA Times website, latimes.com/technology, or they can follow you on Twitter. The username to look up is David Kolker, all one word, and spelled with a K, K-C-O-L-K-E-R.
And as Toshiba would say, domo arigato for coming on our show.
Oh, wow. Oh,
very nicely done. Doze logo. I just completely murdered that, but I tried.
Sayonara.
Bye.
Thank you very much. Bye.
Thanks a lot.
Well, that was very nice of David to join us and fill us in, at least on the TV side of things. I know that CES, it's so huge and fills so many convention halls in Las Vegas. There are so many different gadgets and cell phones and video cameras. And this year, one of the big things was, of course, the e-reader. Everybody's trying to chase Amazon with its Kindle and tablet computing. But, Michael, you asked a question in the show notes about whether everybody's just kind of holding their breath, waiting for Apple to release whatever it's going to release as far as a tablet computer goes later this month.
Exactly. HP released a couple of different models of what they want to do. They're working with Microsoft, and everybody felt like they just announced their product because they had to be first because they knew Apple was coming out and it might make them look lame in comparison. So they just wanted to get it out there and say, we're going to do it. And other people showed tablets that are sort of geared for magazines and newspaper reading. But I think everybody, including me, is just waiting to see what Apple does in February when they finally announce their sort of tablet type product.
Yeah. And I think one thing that we didn't get too into was something, Karen, I know you wanted to talk about was internet on television and boxing.
Because that really fascinates me. That's something I would actually consider doing. 3D, I have no interest in.
Right. Yeah. If it was easy, I would be doing it. I'm not that excited about watching YouTube clips on my TV, but, you know,
no,
if they make it
streaming,
easy enough.
I'm talking about Hulu or ABC.com, that kind of stuff I find really interesting. I could care less about watching YouTube stuff.
And you got to have a nice high-speed connection in your home. I mean,
well,
my
I have
computer.
That. Who doesn't have that? Anybody who would
like
well, anybody
70%
who would
of
buy some.
Don't.
No, that's not true. But anybody who would DSL buy
is not in, DSL is not in more than a third of homes. It's not.
No, but between DSL and cable, close to
70%. DSL and cable, high speed internet connections is not at 50%. It's not.
But people who don't have high speed internet connections wouldn't have any interest in boxing anyway.
Right, but mine is still slow sometimes. Mine gets slow all the time. Some things crawl. You got to reboot. It just
My digital feed on my TV sucks. I mean, how often do you get it where it just is stuck?
Well, we'll have to talk about Boxy and some of the internet-enabled television news. Maybe on another episode, we'll have to do a segment on that.
Yeah. What's next, Sperling?
Well, what's next is Big Deal or Big Whoop, where we take a look at the week's top entertainment news stories and decide whether they are a big deal or whether anyone should care about them. This week, we have former NBC head Ben Silverman. His production company, Electus, which is kind of an online production company, is striking a deal with Yahoo. And he's going to, I guess, feed content to Yahoo. He even struck a deal with Jason Bateman and actor Will Arnett to produce a show that will be advertising driven. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
I haven't decided yet. I'll have to see what his very first content effort is.
It's a big whoop because it's a deal with Yahoo. That's like making a deal with Ask Jeeves. Who cares?
Well, okay, moving on. Lost, is it a TV show or a franchise that will live on?
That's right. As Lost is coming to its big finale, ABC is suddenly saying, yeah, you know, they see in the future, they see novelizations and comic books and other TV shows. I guess new people will get stranded on the island, you know, like Lost, The Next Generation, a feature film. I think it's an unbelievably bizarre idea. And the producers of the show are like, what are they talking about? We want people to know it's ending and give them a sense of finality. So I think it's really bizarre of ABC to be talking about this before they've even reached the finale of this series. So I think it's a, a, a dangerous big whoop. But Karen, what do you think? Is it a big deal or big whoop that they think it could be a franchise?
Nobody cares.
Moving on then. Avatar gets Best Screenplay nod from the WGA. The original screenplay Avatar, Hangover, 500 Days of Summer, A Serious Man, and Hurt Locker were all tapped for Best Screenplay, or I should say Best Screenwriter. Adapted screenplays Crazy Heart, Precious, Julie and Julia, Star Trek, and Up in the Air. What did you guys think?
I think it is a big deal only because it doesn't belong in this category.
Well, I think it's No, it certainly doesn't belong as a best screenplay because it's a terrible screenplay. But I think the picks overall are good. I think they're a big deal because they're definitely precursors to the Oscars. And I'm really happy to see 500 Days of Summer and Star Trek and Up in the Air in there. So Avatar is clearly going to be up for best picture and screenplay and production design and special effects. So it's a big deal. It's a definite precursor to the Oscars.
Also a big deal were the DGA nominations. Kathryn Bigelow, only the seventh female director to be nominated. For The Hurt Locker, James Cameron, Lee Daniels, Jason Reitman, Quentin Tarantino. Lee Daniels is the first African-American, believe it or not, to be nominated, probably because Spike Lee doesn't belong to the DGA. Speaking of directors, Roman Polanski asked to be sentenced in absentia. He wrote a letter to the court and said, look, sentence me, I'll be in Switzerland. Big deal or big whoop?
Big whoop. Roman Polanski was so last month.
Last year.
It's a big whoop because, of course, he wants to be sentenced in absentia. That's why he's avoided coming to America for the last 30 years.
Although I like what you said on Twitter, though. Where's absentia?
Yeah, my tweet was, where's absentia? Sarah Palin joins Fox News as a commentator. Surprising, no one. Michael, big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal, because we were wondering if she's going to talk show, was she going to do this, was she going to that. She was so busy as governor. It's nice that she could quit so she could have time to be an occasional commentator on Fox News. She shows her cashing in, just like the book deal. I think the kid is right.
Karen?
A big deal. Absolutely a big deal, and I totally called it.
I'd have to agree with that. Mariah Carey gives rambling speech at Palm Springs Film Festival. Apparently, Carey went on stage with Lee Daniels, the director of Precious, and of course she starred in Precious, and she gave this rambling speech. We'll place a link to it in the show notes. And then later at the People's Choice Awards, she kind of said, well, we may have had a little champagne. You think? She was totally drunk. Is this a big deal or a big whoop? Has it affected her chances for any type of awards nominations? Michael?
It's a big whoop because she had no chance for an award nomination. She's glad to be in a movie that's doing well.
I big whoop for the exact same reason.
Yeah, I could have cared less, although you should watch it. It's kind of funny. Well, I guess that wraps it up for Big Deal, Big Whoop. That brings us to our other popular segment, Inside Baseball. Today's Inside Baseball topic is one we've discussed before and one that I'm particularly interested in, and that is the issue of release windows. No doubt many of our North American listeners will be interested in this topic as well. At least they will be once they hear the news that on Wednesday of last week, Netflix agreed to a deal with Warner Brothers that would delay the studio's DVD releases to Netflix customers by 28 days while increasing the number of Warner films which would be available for digital streaming through the service. As part of this agreement, Warner Brothers will lower the per-disc price it charges Netflix to purchase their DVDs. Of course, this could save Netflix millions of dollars. Joining us to discuss all of this news and all the related issues surrounding the announcement is Will Richman, president of Broadband Directions, a market intelligence, publishing, and consulting firm specializing in broadband-delivered video, as well as the editor of Video News, a daily online publication featuring broadband video news, which can be found at videonews.com. And I should spell that because it's VideoNuze.com. We'll place a link to it in the show notes. Will can also be found on Twitter. The username to look up is Video News, spelled exactly like the website. Will, thank you for joining us.
Great. Thanks for having me, Sperling.
Of course, our first question earlier in the show, we were discussing whether broadband penetration, at least here in North America, had surpassed 30%. Do you know what broadband penetration is into the home?
Yeah, it's somewhere around 70%. There are something probably just shy of 70%. It's the math is something like about 70 million, give or take 70 million homes in the U.S. that have broadband internet access, and there are about 110 million homes total in the U.S., so it's just shy of 70%.
Well, the reason we wanted to talk to you, Will, is you wrote a post on Video News last week titled, why Netflix's long-term focus in new Warner Brothers deal is a win for everyone. Can you explain why you believe that to be true?
Sure. So you already provided a little bit of a synopsis there on what the deal contemplates. You know, basically that Netflix will not rent any Warner Brothers DVD within the first 28 days that it's released on DVD in exchange for getting lower prices on the DVDs that it purchases from Warner Brothers, and that it'll get better access to Warner Brothers home video content for its Watch Instantly streaming feature. So you can look at this from three perspectives: why it's a win for Netflix, why it's a win for Hollywood, and why it's a win for consumers. Let me recap each one of those. It's a win for Netflix because Netflix's number one issue right now is improving its streaming catalog. Right now, there are about 125,000 titles available on DVD from Netflix, available for rental. That's the traditional business, of course, from Netflix that we all know and love, the red envelope business. They have about 17,000 titles, so something like 15% or so of their current DVD library available for streaming. So obviously, it's just a fraction of what they have available on DVD they have available in streaming. Their number one issue is trying to increase that streaming catalog because, as everybody agrees, the DVD business is going away slowly over time in favor of digital delivery over a broadband and wireless network. So Netflix needs to get its catalog up, and there are really only a couple of ways for it to do so. It can go into the market and try to outspend incumbents, but that's a very difficult concept because the primary rights holders for electronic delivery of Hollywood films are the premium cable channels, HBO, Showtime, Stars, and Epix. They actually have a deal with Stars, but they're unlikely to achieve deals with the others, which means they're effectively foreclosed from the output that the major studios currently give to have deals to give to the cable channels I just mentioned. So what Netflix was able to do in this deal with Warner Brothers is not necessarily increase its access to new releases, but get access to Warner Brothers' catalog. Warner Brothers has the largest catalog of any studio, and there's a lot of value in there. It's not just new releases, and it's important to also note that Netflix has publicly said that only about 30% of its rentals are actually new releases. So there's a very substantial amount of Netflix activity that has nothing to do with recently released DVDs. So Netflix also has extremely good intelligence on what its 11 million users want to rent because they have some of the most sophisticated algorithms out there for tracking what their users rent and what they would like to rent. So they pretty much know that there's little downside to them in creating this 28-day window because most people didn't really care about it in the first place. From Hollywood's perspective, it's a win because DVD has been, for the last, you know, X number of years, the largest revenue producer for Hollywood studios. In 2009, it actually slipped slightly to number two because it was down by about 13%, just behind theatrical revenue. That's the first time in years that DVD has not been the most important revenue source for Hollywood studios. So it's very important for Hollywood to try to figure out how to preserve as much of the declining DVD sales as it possibly can. And this 28-day window will help. Now, how much it'll help is unknown, but what I would assert is that any little bit that it does help to preserve Hollywood's DVD economics is only a win for them. Nobody would expect that DVD revenue is all of a sudden going to spike as a result of this type of a deal, but it will surely help in some ways offset the cannibalization that DVD rental has on DVD sales. So from Hollywood's perspective, it's a win, and Netflix obviously has become a very important customer of Hollywood's. So to the extent that Netflix can be a good partner to Hollywood and Hollywood can benefit from that, that's a win for them. The least obvious and probably most controversial is whether this new deal is beneficial for consumers. So that's sort of the third constituency here. And I would argue that while it may not feel like a benefit to consumers in the short term, in the long term, it's very much a benefit. In the short term, people in the blogosphere and the Twitter sphere have been grousing about the idea that Netflix has taken something away from consumers, the idea that they've had in the past no such DVD window. In other words, as soon as a movie came available on DVD and home video, Netflix was able to get it. Now, of course, anybody who's ever tried actually renting a recently released popular title from Netflix knows that it can be a very long wait until you actually get it, because obviously they don't buy enough inventory to satisfy the peak demand that happens right away. So there are very few people that actually get those DVDs right away. For most people, Netflix is more about the depth of catalog over time that they're able to access. And what I would argue is that while there will be there will be some Netflix subscribers that will notice the Warner Brothers titles not being available in the first 28 days, more Netflix subscribers will benefit from the deeper library on the streaming side that Netflix will be able to create as a result of this Warner Brothers deal and potentially other deals down the road. Now, that's beneficial to consumers, not only because they'll get better streaming rights through Netflix, but also because this is a key part of Hollywood's economics. And, you know, to the extent that Netflix can help Hollywood preserve its economics, that only helps to ensure that the types of movies that consumers like to watch, you know, for, you know, i.e. expensive movies with well-known high-paid talent, special effects, you know, fill in the blanks, but basically expensive to produce Hollywood films, the likelihood that those films will continue to be produced is enhanced by Netflix playing its part in developing a digital delivery strategy and a digital delivery financial model for Hollywood. So that's a lot of words to kind of explain what I wrote in my post, but the net of it is that, you know, there are basically three constituencies in the deal. There's Netflix, the studios, and consumers. And from my standpoint, this type of deal, although the details are not yet known, this type of deal, I think, is a win for everybody.
Well, Will, looking at the deal and what you talked about, it seems like it makes perfect sense for Netflix as long as Warner Brothers and the other studios impose similar terms on their competitors. It would be bad if the next 5 years, Blockbuster and Redbox and everybody else had that didn't have to face that window, and Netflix did. In that case, it would seem to be a disadvantage. But they have to believe that Warner Brothers is going to do the same deal with everybody else, right?
I think what you said is right, and there's another player in this ecosystem that's important to discuss, which is Redbox. Some people are familiar with Redbox, a kiosk operator mostly in grocery stores, dollar-a-day rentals. Some studios are friendly toward Redbox. Others are very unfriendly or suing Redbox. This deal also gives the studio, gives Warner Brothers in this case and potentially other studios, more leverage against Redbox as well, because it sort of sets a standard for how DVDs would be accessible in the market, so for rental. So that's another sort of angle to this deal. But you're right, to the extent that DVD rentals were available from Warner Brothers through other outlets, Netflix could potentially be harmed.
And after the 28-day window, are those new releases going to be available for streaming or just for rental?
Yeah, no, this has nothing to do with streaming. This is just rental, the 28-day window. As far as streaming goes, another, again, as I mentioned before, set of companies that's very important in this ecosystem are the premium cable channels, who have multi-hundreds of millions of dollars in deals, so-called output deals, with the studios to basically accept whatever films they make to be shown within the pay window in the Hollywood windowing scheduling process. So basically when a film's rights are allocated, HBO, Showtime, et cetera, bid a certain amount to get the output of those studios to play on their channels within a certain time period. And these, as I understand it, this Warner Brothers deal will not in any way provide Netflix with improved access to recent releases, i.e. those releases that are currently allocated in their electronic delivery window to HBO, et cetera, but rather will improve their rights to the Warner Brothers catalog instead.
Well, writing for the opposing opinion was TechCrunch's MG Sigler, and in his post, he talked a little bit about the fact that this might lead to higher piracy rates. He writes, they might as well scream out, please pirate our movies for the next 4 weeks before you rent them cheaply and we make any kind of money. Do you think this release strategy will actually cause piracy to increase?
Well, look, piracy is already an issue. You know, I wrote a response to MG, and you know, my reaction is that there will always be people who do not respect copyright and think stealing is acceptable. So there's very little that you can do about those people except, you know, start taking them to court, as the music industry has, you know, begun to do. That has its own set of downsides. So, you know, piracy is always going to exist, but I think to the idea that this is going to create pirates out of Netflix users is very unlikely. The reality is that Netflix, with 11 million subscribers, is very much a mainstream-oriented business now. And I would argue that the vast majority of Netflix users are not going to pirate movies, both because they don't know how to pirate movies in the first place, also because they don't want to learn how to pirate movies, and finally, because they think it's wrong. You know, most mainstream people think it's wrong to steal. And just because there's now a 28-day window does not mean that all of a sudden those people who don't know how, don't want to learn, and think it's wrong are going to, you know, turn themselves inside out. So I think the likelihood of piracy increasing is relatively low.
Well, it will be interesting to see how it all plays out and whether other studios will sign on, presumably they will, and we thank you for joining us here today to help us unravel this news about Netflix and Warner Brothers' deal for a delayed rental window.
Great. Well, thank you very much for having me.
Thanks. Talk to you soon.
Well, I have two things to say.
Yeah.
One, I love the irony of this, because when video cassettes came out, this was reversed. We had a rental window. Rental came first for like, you'd put out a VHS tape for like $90 or $100. You would charge the video stores, and it would be 6 months or a year or longer, if ever, before they made it available for sale at like $20 or $25. Now we've come full circle. Now we're selling it for the first month, and then we'll make it available for rental. So that's kind of amusing. But I do disagree that DVD sales are going to disappear and people are only going to stream. I think rentals, it makes a lot more sense to stream a movie. But I think as far as sales and for owning a movie, I think people still want to collect them. They still want to own them. People spent $16 billion renting and buying DVDs last year. It's going to be a long time before DVDs go away.
I think Reed Hastings said 20 years.
That's certainly reasonable. But, you know, I don't know if it would disappear even then. I mean, you never know. But it just seems the desire to have a book on your shelf, a CD on your shelf, a DVD on your shelf with all the extras. I mean, none of these streaming DVDs have any extras the way that you have loaded with extras. So, and people love that stuff. So,
well, Reed Hastings also said in the New York Times, quote, our number one objective now is expanding the digital catalog.
Well, that's smart. That's perfect for Netflix. Absolutely. But again, that's rental. I still think there'll be desire. You know, you want to rent a movie, streaming makes perfect sense. There's no reason why it shouldn't supersede going to a store or even mailing it in from Netflix, assuming it doesn't cost $6, $8 the way they do for high def rental, but video on demand. But, you know, for owning a movie, I think people still want to own movies.
I think they do, but I think that they want to keep them in their digital lockers, which is something I know Sperling we will talk about next week.
Yes, hopefully next week or in an upcoming episode. And again, I'd like to thank Will Richmond from Video News for joining us to talk about the Netflix story. Of course, he can be followed on Twitter. The username to look up is Video News, and we'll place links to his website and his Twitter account in our show notes. Speaking of our show notes, they can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That is also where you'll find information to email us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. Or you can leave us a voicemail, 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. Also on our website are links to all of our social networking accounts. Now, the music you hear at the beginning and end of each episode of Showbiz Sandbox is by the popular indie rock group Management, MGMT. They can be found on their website, whoismgmt.com, or on MySpace, myspace.com/MGMT. Now, Michael Giltz can be found on michaelgiltz.com, as he can every week. All links to all of his writing can be found there. And is there anything else you'd like to plug this week?
No.
No? Okay. Michael is also on Twitter. Michael Giltz is the username to look up. Karen is on Twitter. Karen_Woodward is the username to look up. You can also find links to all of her writing at KarenWoodwardOnline.com. I can be found on Twitter. My username is simply Sperling. And you can find my writing on CelluloidJunkie.com. Well, Karen, Michael, thank you very much for another fun-filled week of entertainment news. Until next week, play nice.